Hello, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to American Warrior Radio. This is your host, Ben Buehler-Garcia. 6 kilometers north of Krems, Austria, lay a complex surrounded by barbed wire and guard towers. This was Stalag 17B, one of the Nazis' most notorious prisoner of war camps. Nearly 30,000 POWs from various nations were crowded into the camp, including almost 4,500 U.S. non-commissioned officers. Allow me to read to you from a report by the War Department Military Intelligence Service dated 15 July 1944. Description: camp consists of 12 compounds, 5 of them holding Americans, the others Italians, Russians, French, Serbs. Each American compound holds 4 double barracks, 100 foot by 240 feet, holding 400 men each. Treatment: treatment by guards and administrative personnel is harsh and restrictions are oppressive. Relations between POWs and Germans are poor. 3 POWs in this camp have been shot under circumstances appearing to be in violation of the Geneva Convention, and others have been beaten. Treatment in this camp is worse than the other German camps, with the exception of Stalag 2B. Food: poor in quality and quantity. In January, German ration was cut in half as consequences of the rich supply of Red Cross food, quote-unquote. Supply of Red Cross food was exhausted 5 May when one parcel was issued to each of the 5 POWs instead of the usual parcel per man per week. Health: situation is bad. 25 wounded men are arriving weekly. Many wear field dressings 2 and 3 weeks old. Chief American medical officer declares badly needed medical supplies shipped from Geneva are held up by the Germans. 3 American medical officers and a dentist are there. 2 prisoners of this camp wrote a play about their experiences, which eventually became the 1953 movie Stalag 17, for which William Holden won an Academy Award for Best Actor. But that was a movie, and Holden was an actor. Today, we're joined by one of the real American heroes who was incarcerated in that camp during World War II. Walter Ramm is 96 years young, and folks, you're in for a treat. Walter, welcome to American Warrior Radio.
Thank you very much, Ben. If you want to hear some of my story, shall I go ahead with it?
I'll guide you through that, Walter. I know you've got a lot to tell, and we have very little time. But let's start off. You were born and raised in Nogales, Arizona, and like some of your generation, you began your military career with a lie. Right?
That is correct. Yes, I was born in Nogales, Arizona, on December 20th. 1923. It was a Thursday morning, very, very cold morning. I grew up and went through the deep depression of the 30s. And in 1940, which will be 80 years ago this year, I joined the infantry at the age of 16 years of age. I joined for 1 year, and I went to Oklahoma, Texas, and the largest of maneuvers in this country we've had since 1940. That was in 1940, and all the big generals that participated in the war of World War II in Europe were in that place, including Eisenhower, Patton, Bradley, and other big boys. I was there for 1 year. After 1 year, I was discharged, and as I had promised my mother when I first left at 16, that I was going to go back to high school. Just about as I was ready to go back, Japan bombed Pearl Harbor, and not wanting to go back into the infantry, because I was fully trained, I went and joined the Air Force. At that time, it used to be called the United States Air Corps. I wanted to be a pilot, but being that I didn't have a high school diploma, I had quit high school to join the first time. I did not have a high school diploma, so I was not accepted as a cadet. So when I found out that I could fly, even though I had never been in a plane in my life, I could fly. If I became a radio man, I volunteered for that. And before too long, after radio school and after gunnery school, I was a crew member on a B-24 Liberator. Trained so long on a B-24, and when I was ready to go overseas, they pulled me out, put me in a plane from a Pueblo, Colorado air base, and sent me to El Paso, Texas, Big Field Air Base. There they put me on a B-17 as a radio man. I was qualified to be on a 17. As the equipment in a B-24 and a B-17 were identical, so I got in a crew, and after my pilot and co-pilot got enough training as pilots, because they were terrible, it wasn't their fault they were terrible, they were just learning how to fly a 17, Every time the plane touched down, we would hit 5, 6, 7 times before the plane stayed on the ground. But we stayed with it. Well, one thing I'll take a little time to say. We used to flight engineer Tom Hamilton and myself would stand right behind a pilot and co-pilot, and we would say, "I'll bet you we hit 5 times. I'll bet you we hit 6 times before we stop." And the pilot and co-pilot were listening to all of that there. And after hitting the ground 5 or 6 times, we would bet a dollar, we'd change the dollars also. And then they never liked it, but they never said anything. Anyway.
Now, Walter, let me ask you a question. Was it set up so that the crew that you trained with in El Paso, was the idea then that complete crew would then go overseas and man the aircraft during the war? Or did you kind of get mixed up again once you got assigned over in England?
No. As a matter of fact, when they pulled me out of Colorado, flying MB-24s to Big Seal, Texas, they had just started building the 94th Bomb Group, of which I was part of. And our crew consisted of only the pilot and the flight engineer, Willard Remke, the pilot, and Tom Hamilton, the engineer. I was the third person to be to join that crew, and after that, they gave us another one, another one, until we got the full 10 persons, the full 10 crews. And that's the same crew that trained in the States, the same crew that went overseas, and the same crew that flew combat. The only one we changed was our navigator, because the navigator had the habit of losing us, and that was very dangerous. On one occasion, when we were going from I'll say one little before. When we were going to go overseas, we went to Salina, Kansas, where they outfitted our plane completely. They put an extra bladder for fuel, and they put a lot of extra airplane parts, engine parts, and all that for planes that were already in England. So we took from there. We were going to Africa, South America, and Africa, and then up north to England. But as we left Salina, Kansas. Someone had sabotaged our engines. They poured iron filings in the oil in our engines. So we never made it to our first destination. The whole squadron, which at that time consisted of about 6 planes, we made emergency landings in different places. And anyway, we went as far as Jackson, Mississippi, where we stayed 3 months because they changed the engine that was bad, the burning. And they didn't know about the other engines, and being we were going overseas and going to go to combat in that same plane, they decided, and they changed all 4 engines on the plane. When they got through, instead of going to South America, they changed our orders, and we went the northern route, which consisted we went to Goose Bay, Labrador, and from there we flew to Iceland, and we flew over the tip of Greenland, but we didn't land in Greenland. We went to Iceland. Now, when we were supposed to be in Iceland, we couldn't find it. And all our tanks were marked in red. We were almost out of fuel. Our navigator couldn't find it. So that's where my radio came in handy. My pilot asked me, ordered me to call Iceland and get us a course, which I did. I would call Iceland, hold my key down. They would triangulate us. And they could tell exactly where we're at, and that way they could tell us which course to take, what degree to take, which we did.
Wow.
Anyway, from there from Iceland we went to that was Reykjavik, Iceland. From Reykjavik, Iceland, we went to England, first Scotland, and then to our base, which was at Bessingbourne, England.
Now, Walter,
Bessingbourne was not our base. That was a base for the 91st Bomb Group, which consisted of, amongst other planes, the Memphis Belle.
Right.
We used to.
And Walter, I tell you what, we've got to take our first break here to pay for the show. But so you mentioned you're with the 94th Bombardment Group, 331st Squadron, 8th Air Force, and that's an interesting tidbit of not trivia, but you did fly some original missions with the Memphis Belle. Ladies and gentlemen, this is your host Ben Bueller Garcia. We're joined by Walter Ram, 96 years young, and his story gets even more intriguing. Stick around; you're going to want to hear the rest of us. Here at American Warrior Radio, we consider it our duty to share the stories of the brave men and women who protect us at home and abroad. Our audience is growing, but there's still so many more ears that need to hear these important messages. Will you lend us a hand? Please consider supporting our mission by becoming a patron of American Warrior Radio. For the price of one cup of coffee a month, you can help us extend our reach and earn some great prizes in the process. Learn more by visiting patreon.com/American Warrior Radio. That's patreon.com/American Warrior Radio. Thank you. Welcome back to American Warrior Radio. Ladies and gentlemen, this is your host, Ben Bueller Garcia. We're joined by Walter Ram. Walter flew several missions as a member of a B-17 crew during World War II. They were shot down. He spent the rest of his military career in the infamous Stalag 17. Walter, I want to talk about those missions, but first a question. Back in those days, a lot of the crews named their aircraft, and they painted the name on the nose of the aircraft. Your plane was called Hell No Gal, and that's an interesting story. What's the story behind that, Walter?
Actually, replacing the engines in Jackson, Mississippi, as I stated before, we decided to go ahead and name our plane, get a name. We didn't have one selected or anything. So there were 10 crew members, and only one of the 10 crew members was married. All of us were single. And so the only one married was a co-pilot. And he insisted. He get up there in a loud voice. He says, "I want a plane named Corky." Corky was his wife's nickname. And all nine of us on the side said, "Hell no! We didn't want that name." So somewhere or another, that name stuck to our plane, the Hell No Gal.
All right, that's a good story. Now, you actually were in two aircraft that went down on your, well, let me back up a little bit. I believe, Walter, was on your second mission, you volunteered to fly with another crew to get some experience. But then on your, let's talk briefly about your third mission, because that was kind of rough.
Yes. Well, my first mission was my pilot and I were the only two of our crew members to fly. We flew with another crew with a pilot that had experience already, had combat missions. My pilot went as a co-pilot, and I went as a first radio man. And I think I was more afraid of the pilot we had in the plane. He was a big, old, rough-looking guy. And I think when on that first mission, I was more afraid of him than I was of the German fighters. Anyway, we went through the whole thing, and he told me, "Sergeant, hang on to those earphones because we're liable to get a call, change targets." In other words, we always had an alternate target in case the first one wasn't available for whatever reason. Anyway, we went through that mission. When I saw the first German fighters attacking us, that didn't bother me much. I was worried about the pilot. And anyway, went through the whole mission. Nobody was hurt on that mission. Our plane came out with quite a few holes from German fighters. And we bombed a target outside of Paris, an airfield that the Germans were using to bomb London. Anyway, we went back, and that's the first time I saw the cliffs of Dover, the white cliffs of Dover. They looked pretty, and I felt pretty good because I knew from then on we were over friendly country. But anyway, that was mission number one. When mission number two came along, my plane was not able to fly because the holes had not been covered up. So there was another crew that were ready to go, but they needed a radio man because their radio man had been killed on the mission before. So their pilot, we were all like a big family there. Their pilot asked me, "Ram, would you fly with us? We need a radio man." And I told him, "Well, I have to get permission from my pilot." He was my immediate commander. When I asked him, he says, "Ram, you don't want to go. You don't want to go," because he knew that our chances of coming back were 50-50 at best. And he didn't want to lose his radio man. But anyway, regardless, I still went. I was young. I was either very brave or I was very dumb. I wasn't afraid of anything. So anyway, went on that mission. We bombed Flensburg naval installations, submarine installations. Flensburg is located right next to Denmark. That was a long trip, and we had a tough time, but we made it back. The third mission is the one where all the crew flew together for the first time. I was already one mission. I had on my pilot, and two missions ahead of the radio, of the rest of the crew. And our third mission, we went to bomb Emden, Germany. And again, we were bombing submarine installations. As the German subs were knocking our ships quite heavily over in the Atlantic, on the land ships, victory ships or whatever else they call them. And anyway, right after we had bombed our target, we were hit on engine number two with a 20 millimeter. And before too long, well, we kept up with the whole group. Being Emden is right on the coast of North Germany, right in the middle, right on the coast. As after the bombing, we took off out over the open sea, which is the North Sea. And before too long, our engine started burning. And we couldn't keep up with the formation, so we became a straggler. The rules were, if you can't keep up, tough luck. You go on your own. And it was very, very dangerous to be by yourself out there. If the Germans knew we were there by ourselves, they would have finished us off real fast. And then when the pilot asked our navigator, the one that lost us in Iceland, he asked the navigator, the course from where we were at over the open sea, we were by ourselves, and we wanted to get to the closest land on England. And so what the pilot was doing, he was going west, but we were heading more towards Scotland. And that's a lot farther than the bottom part of England. And the navigator couldn't give him a course. He gave him a couple of courses wrong. And finally, the pilot called me and he said, "Ram, break radio silence." That was terrible. "Break radio silence and call England and get us a course," which I did. I got England, and when I got to England, I asked for a course. We had several signals that we used to contact, all in international Morse code, which I learned in radio school. I gave him the course, and he corrected the course, and we went. And all that time, our engine was burning. And then the tire, when retracted, it's right under the engine, and the tire caught fire. So we had a big old fire, big old flames, black smoke and everything. And we kept them going for, I don't know how many hours, 2 or 3 hours like that, till the tire burned completely off. All the inside of the engine was gutted, and we were losing another engine quit, engine number three. The two engines next to the fuselage are the ones. The first one is the one on the left side, the other one, second one on the right side. So we were flying on two engines, and we were losing altitude. We started the whole thing at 25,000 feet, and we kept on going down and down and down and down. And before, quite a ways later on, we met another B-17. The same B-17 that I had flown in on my own when we went and bombed Flensburg. And he had the same trouble. His engine was burning, the same engine. And when he got closer to us, he went parallel to us. And both of us were flying losing altitude, but the planes were burning. And before too long, their left wing, it didn't fall off completely off, but it crumbled back and the plane nosed down. We saw five or six parachutes go out, but none of them deployed fully, so that they all died when they hit the water. So and I sent a signal to England, giving their tail number, because in briefing, that's a longer story, but I don't have the time for that. In briefing, they gave us a code for each plane. When you called England, if you were in flight or whatever happened in the emergency or whatever, you used the code instead of using your plane number. But being that I didn't have their code number, I gave the last three numbers, which were 727, the last three numbers on their tail. And then that's where they went down. excuse me. We kept them going and going. When we got down to 2,000 feet, our pilot asked us if we wanted to bail out, because that was the ideal point to bail out. And anything further below than that wasn't too good. So we looked down we looked down at the water. You could see the white caps and the water colder than blazes. So we told them we're going to stick with the ship. He said, "Okay, throw everything out." So we threw everything out. All our heavy clothing, the machine guns in the windows that we could take out, the radio gun that we could take out, all my radio equipment I wasn't using, hundreds of, God only knows, maybe thousands of empty 50 caliber machine gun shells that had fallen on the floor as we were firing at the enemy. threw everything out we could, and we still kept a losing altitude, kept on going and going. In the meantime, with my radio, I kept notifying England every 15 or 20 minutes as to where we were at by giving them a signal, and they would triangulate us again, and they knew where we were at. I was doing that because we were expecting to go down in the ocean. And if we were down in the ocean, if we were close to England, they would come over and drop dinghies that had food, that had water, and had radio equipment in it so that we can contact them. They would come and help us, pick us up if they could. Anyway, we kept on going and going and going and going until finally we saw land, which is in the eastern part of England. There's a bump that sticks out over the water, great big piece of England. And as we hit land, all the altitude we had left was treetop level. So as soon as we hit land, we crashed. We made a belly landing, crash landing, and everything came out okay. The plane didn't. We were expecting to keep on burning, but it did not burn anymore after that. I think everything burnable had been burned already.
Walter.
We got out of the plane real fast, got away from the plane in case it burned or exploded or whatever.
And Walter, I'll tell you,
within 30 minutes, there was a truck come over, an English truck with English soldiers, and with them was an American lieutenant, and they knew where we were at on account of my radio signals. They picked us up. First, they checked us out, see if we were okay. We all had scratches or whatnot. I still have scars on my arms from that. And they took us over to the English base that was close by, and we were all dying for a cup of coffee. So they took us into a hangar, and there instead of coffee, they gave us tea and crumpets.
Walter.
And they checked us, and then by truck, they took us to our base. Our base, we went through interrogation. We told them what happened and the whole thing. Then we dressed and went to London, to our favorite little bar, which was called the Georgian Dragon. And I'll tell you, we celebrated real good.
Well,
our plane never flew again. We waited till we got a new plane, which was a Hal Nagel II.
Walter,
aside from a new plane, we got a new navigator.
I'm going to have to interrupt you there because we do have to take another break. We only get you 10 minutes at a time. Sounds like you maybe need to run out and get a drink of water as well. But I tell you, that story reminds me, they always say, you know, a good landing, any landing that you can walk away from is a good landing. So that describes that landing. When we come back, I want to talk briefly about your sixth mission and then your time in Stalag 17. Ladies and gentlemen, this is your host, Ben Bueller Garcia. We're joined by Walter Ram. We'll be right back. Welcome back to American Warrior Radio. Ladies and gentlemen, we're very, very pleased to be joined by an amazing storyteller telling his own story. Walter Ram flew six missions in B-17s over Europe during the Second World War. They were shot down on their sixth mission, the 13th of June, if I'm not mistaken. Walter, we hope you got a little bit of tea or a little bit of water there for your voice so we can keep going. When we left off, you got a brand new B-17, a B-17F. And you went on your sixth mission, and things went pretty much downhill from there.
Right. With a new plane, we bombed Wilhelmshaven. In Germany, we bombed Saint-Nazaire, France. Then came the last mission, sixth mission. On the sixth mission, the bad thing, we were tail end Charlie, and then the two planes on our sides aborted. One of them aborted because they had engine trouble. And the one on the right side, the one on the left side, aborted, claiming engine trouble. But I understand that when he got to England, when he got back to our base, that they would check those engines, and they found out that the one on the left side did not have any trouble at all. He just chickened out, and so that left us wide open, just like a finger sticking out. So when we were attacked, we were the first ones, and they kept attacking us. We went all the way to the target. By the time we got to a target, our plane was burning ferociously. There were explosions and everything inside. One of the explosions knocked me completely off. I was standing up firing my machine gun, and I was knocked completely off and hit up the side of the plane. I hit it so hard it broke my nose, broke my shoulder, burned my face, and all my right side was all lacerated. I was on the floor of the plane for, I don't know, a few seconds or whatever time it was, I don't know. When I gained enough senses again, I got up and got back to my machine gun and kept firing again, not realizing that I didn't have, amongst other things, I didn't have my oxygen mask. So at 25,000 feet without oxygen, I didn't last too long. Before I knew it, I was on the floor. I was passing out. I was dying, actually, from lack of oxygen. And the last thing I remember, a ball turret gunner who was the only one standing, because I could see the waist gunners, and they were both down already. They were both dead. The waist gunner was still standing up. He was walking around with a ball of oxygen. And anyway, the last thing I remember, he was extending his arm to help me. I assumed that he threw me out of the plane. He threw me out. I was in an unconscious form, but I guess he figured out it had a better chance that way than staying in the plane itself. And anyway, I don't know how I managed to open my parachute in that condition that I was in. But I must have opened that parachute quite far down because I know that I hurt all my joints, my ankles, my knees, my hips, my shoulders. And today, all my life, I have suffered from back injuries. My spinal cord in the bottom is twisted. I must have hit the ground real hard. But the VA does a good job in taking care of me.
Walter, the fellow that threw you out of the plane, that ball turret gunner, if I'm not mistaken, that was Chuck Lewis?
That is correct, yes.
And he did not survive. Only four of you survived that shoot down, correct?
That is correct, yes.
Okay.
Actually, all of this I'm assuming, that after he threw me out, we knew one of the other guys by the waist gunners, one of them was definitely gone. He was dead. But the other one just facing down. And I kind of believe that Chuck must have gone in to try and help him. But he had been down for quite a while. He had to have been dead. I believe that Chuck went back to help him when the plane tipped over. And then Chuck couldn't get out. And that's how I think Chuck just stayed in there just a little too long, which was very admirable. I told my interrogators when I was released from prison 2 years later about it. I was hoping they would give him some sort of a commendation, which they never did. But anyway, I woke up actually approximately, we were shot down at about 9 o'clock in the morning, and I woke up in a German civilian hospital with a German soldier guard at about close to 3 p.m. According to one of my crew members who had hit the ground before I did, they bailed out before I did. He told me that after I was down, they picked me up in a two-wheel cart pulled by an ox, and they rode me in there. I was on the floor. They took me to a barn. In the barn, they threw me on the floor of a truck, and from there they took us to the hospital. When I woke up, I was already completely undressed with a hospital garb, and there was an old lady looking at me. At least I thought at that time, being that I was 19 years old, this nurse must have been about 40, 45 years old or so. To me, she was an old lady.
Ancient.
But I'll say she is the only one in all my experience in Germany that treated me decently, treated me nice.
Walter, I don't want to be rude, but...
I stayed at that hospital a couple of days, and then they transferred me north of the border of Denmark to Flensburg, the target that I had bombed when I flew with the other plane. And then they kept me a few days. Oh, by the way, they took my flight suit off away from me, and they gave me an American uniform, probably from somebody else that died. But they didn't have shoes, so they gave me Dutch wooden clods, which I used from Flensburg. They took me to Frankfurt, Germany, and I thought I was going to another hospital, but instead it was in the SS headquarters.
Mm-hmm.
You know who the SS are?
Oh, yeah.
They're the famous people that ran all the Holocaust camps, and they're the ones that trained the Gestapo's how to be killers and all. They were mean people, and I was interrogated, and all the answers that I gave them, they wanted my name, rank, and serial number I gave them. They wanted all my other answers, and all my answers were, I don't know, I don't know, I don't know. And my interrogator which was dressed very immaculate in a black uniform. He was a tall, well-built guy, and he stood up about halfway through my interrogation, took out his gun, and kept asking me questions, and kept saying, "I don't know, I don't know." And he put his gun on my head, and he kept asking me questions. I don't know how I was so brave that I kept on telling him, "I don't know, I don't know." I think I kind of believe the trauma of being a prisoner. I think the trauma of being burned. By the way, my face at the first hospital had been covered up completely, completely bandaged. I had a little hole for my mouth where I ate a liquid diet, and I had a little hole in one of my eyes where that I could see out. The other eye was completely shot from the burns. But anyway, he kept on asking me questions, and I thought I knew I was going to die. Because he had his gun on my head, and he was the type of guy that you couldn't trust, so we say. He was mean looking. And, the only thing that came to my mind was an image of my mother. I guess I was saying goodbye. But luckily for me, instead of pulling the trigger, the guy put his gun back in his holster, threw all his paperwork in his briefcase, looked down at me that I was sitting down, looked down at me and hollered, "You fool. You should have been killed instead of just wounded." And he got out of the room real fast, slammed the door behind him. I never saw him again. I didn't want to see him anymore anyway.
Walter,
and from there they took me to about the two guards that had brought me down. The same two guards took me by train to Berlin. And Berlin was a British prisoner of war camp.
Walter, I tell you, I'm going to have to interrupt you again because we want to get to the Stalag. Stick around, ladies and gentlemen. This is your host, Ben Bueller Garcia. We'll be right back. Welcome back to American Warrior Radio, ladies and gentlemen. We're very pleased to be joined by Walter Ram. Walter, I tell you what, we should have scheduled 2 or 3 hours for you. We've only got about 10 minutes left, and we've got a lot to cover, sir. So if you'll just sort of bear with me, let's talk about the...
We'd have to run and get on a high spot because if the dog caught us, that was the end. So anyway, then after our Air Force and the British Air Force, when they bombed Dresden, the city of Dresden, which was Hitler's favorite city. I had never been there, but they tell me it's a very beautiful city with a lot of spirals and all that. Anyway, they firebombed it for three or four days and nights in a row, and they killed a lot of people and all that. Hitler was real angry, and he ordered all prisoners of war to be killed. That's one time that the German generals disobeyed him. They didn't do it, but we knew about it, but we didn't know what was going to happen. So it just so happened that before too long, they all of a sudden told us to get ready. We were going to go on a march. Now we didn't know if that march was going to be going to start killing us or what, but we were well organized. There's a lot more story, but we were well organized where we could take the camp over anytime we wanted to. We had enough guys. We had over 4,000 prisoners in there. We would take the ground soldiers off first, and with those same rifles, we would take out the towers and then scatter, because if we stayed there, they could drop a couple of bombs on us and finish us off.
Walter,
we went on the march, and march was quite something because we were very hungry. We marched. We slept only out in the country, out in the snow, out in the rain. There was snow on us, and we were completely wet. Our clothing would dry on us. The same thing with rain. We would sleep in the snow. We would sleep on the ground in the rain. Anyway, that's the way it kept on going. We would scrounge from our lines for food, and the Gestapo was behind us. And if they caught you, the Gestapo caught you, got us, or any other guards got us away from our lines, they shoot you. No questions.
Hey, Walter.
So three of us would go hunting for food. Two of us would look for food, and one would keep an eye out to see if any Gestapo or guards were close by that we would get away from. On our scrounges, at one time we stole 3 chickens. We, in another place, we got potatoes that were planting. We ate them like apples. In another place, we ran into a gypsy group that was dressed just the way you see them in the movies, real, brilliant, well-dressed, and an old lady, I gave her cigarettes, and we got some spaghetti from her. When I tried to give her the cigarettes, she wouldn't take them. She was giving us a ticket, but regardless, I still gave her three packs of cigarettes. And further down the line, we were marching, and we saw, we were marching on a dirt road, and then they made us stop and get on each side of the road, open the road. Way up ahead of us, there was another group coming up against us, and when they came up to us, we saw what they were. They were German Jews that had been on a march, but there was nothing left of them. Their skin was touching their skulls. Their eyes, when you saw their eyes, they were just like looking into a black hole. They were really, really, really in bad shape. And when they came right by us, they were just a few feet from us because we were on each side of a narrow road, dirt road. One of the German Jews fell on one knee. That was a death sentence because once it went down, they shoot him. And he looked at us, and that's when we saw their eyes were just a black shadow. And we had no food and all that because. So I went to give this guy right close to me. I went to give him water. That's the only thing we had. And when I went to give him water, someone kicked me on the chest with a flat of his shoe, knocked me down, and shot the guy, shot the German Jew, poor fellow. And anyway, after they all went by, they were all in the same condition. When they all went by, walking very, very slow, they had no energy left. Then they got us back on the march. And then a little farther down, there was another dead one, and another dead one, another dead one. I don't know how many we saw. And way at the end, there was a German wagon, like our old Western Conestoga wagons, without the top. The only difference was their sides, the sides of the wagon were higher than our wagons. And the wagon had two German soldiers with black gloves up to their elbows. And every time I saw a dead one, they'd get off, pick it up, and throw them out there like throwing up a log or whatever into the wagon. And God only, I don't know how many there were dead, quite a few of them. And we kept them going like that. And finally, we came to a little town by the name of Brno. Brno was the march had been officially, anyway, Ben, if you have any questions, ask me, then I'll continue.
Well yeah, and I tell you what, Walter, again, we've only got 5 minutes left, and there's so much I want to cover. So let me just, if you don't mind, sir. So you got to Brno on this march, and you saw, you know, most of the villages, all the people already had white flags out. Let me ask you this, sir. Do you think the Germans marched you in that direction because they would rather surrender to the U.S. forces versus the Russian forces?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah. And I'll just say something real fast here. We were liberated by Germans, by Patton's Third Army. And anyway, well, we went into town looking for, the advanced American forces couldn't feed us or not. They had nothing to help us with. So they kept on going, and we went into the little town of Brno, and we were standing in front of a building, and a fellow told us, that building you're standing in front of, that's where Hitler was born and raised. And, you know, we had a lot of anger in us. We had a lot of hate in us. And we wanted to blow the building up. We had nothing to do it with. So the only thing we could do, and we did, we peed all over the walls of Hitler's house.
You should have gotten a medal for that, Walter.
Yes.
Well, and let me, you know, that one other thing that you mentioned, Hitler's folks, when they showed up, they really, they just sort of turned you loose on your own. But they did one thing before they did that. They asked you and your fellow prisoners to identify the guards that had mistreated you the most, and they marched them out in the woods, and let's just say those German guards didn't come back, right?
That is correct. All that we heard was a shot, and the American soldier would come back, except for one guy by the name of Schultz. He's the one that killed our prisoners inside our camp in Salt Lake 17. The guys, they tried to escape. They started climbing the fence. When they were shot from the towers, they crawled back to the safety zone, and that's where Schultz came in. Instead of helping him, he emptied his guns on their heads. I know, because the next morning we went by, and all you could see on the ground was a gray matter from their brains. You know? Mm. So when we were liberated, we got him and we shot him. We shot him in the head, killed him. And we were not the same then as we are today. We had a lot of hate in us. Life was very cheap. We had changed completely. And when we were liberated, to be liberated was a very, it's very, very hard to take. We couldn't, we were asking ourselves, what we've been through. Is that a nightmare? Or are we just waking up? Or what is it, Sin?
Walter?
One
thing, if I can, we've got about just 2 minutes left. Quick questions. You always carry an American flag with you since that experience.
I always carry an American flag that I had drawn on a piece of paper, carried it with me. But on our march, when it were wet, raining on us, and it was so, my little flag disintegrated. So I lost my flag there. Higher in my car, at home, I always fly a flag. In my car, I always carry an American flag. Always carry a flag with me.
God bless you, sir, for doing that, especially nowadays. One other quick question. I saw you with a panel. It was yourself, a couple of Vietnam-era POWs, and one Iraqi War POW, and you were each telling your stories. What is your perspective, Walter, of those who came after you and what they endured?
Well, it was a different type of war. They were not held in camps the way we were. Except for Vietnam. But they ate better than we did, because some of them were held prisoner for 5 years. And when I saw them out of the plane, coming out of the plane, Clark Field in the Philippines, they were well built. So they ate whatever they ate, rice or whatever. And we would not have lasted another year in captivity. And I spent 2 years up there. By the way, I want to finish by saying this. I lost two brothers in the Pacific. In a sense, I lost eight brothers, because the crew members in my plane were all just like brothers. We were very, very close. I lost eight brothers. Two of my older brothers and the six crew members.
Walter, I really, really appreciate you spending time with us here today on American Warrior Radio. I tell you what, brother, we'll have to have you back on again sometime. I'll schedule 3 or 4 hours and we can get into more details. I encourage folks to kind of Google your name. Look up Walter Ram on the internet. There's so much more to this story and so fascinating. And sir, I just want to thank you for your service and thank you for spending some time with us today.
Ben, I appreciate you having me here my story, I would like to have the young people in this country know more about what it is to keep our freedom, because we paid a high price for our freedom, and it's not in dollars and cents. And most of the soldiers we lost were all young guys, say between 20 and 30 years old. And all of those, which included my two brothers, paid a high price for what we enjoy today, our freedom.
Well spoken, sir. Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, you can find this podcast at AmericanWarriorRadio.com. Follow us on Facebook, Twitter. Share this podcast with your friends. Until next time, all policies and procedures are to remain in place. Take care.